thank you very much, all of you, for coming here tonight for the launch of what is a very important volume. The volume is entitled Italy in the International System from the Entente to the End of the Cold War, The Underrated Ally. The editors of the volume, who are both here, Professor Vassori and Dr. Benedetto Zaccaria, have been very lucky in attracting a stellar team of academics, both well-known and every research career people, to put together such a scintillating and thought-provoking volume. Before I start with introductions, I better introduce myself. I am Dr. Effie Bedaglio of LSE-IDES. I'm a historian of the international history of the Cold War, but I have to plead a weakness. Italy is a recurrent theme in my research. Now, we are very lucky to have such a prestigious panel with us tonight to introduce and comment on the book. Before I introduce them, I need to say something. This volume is very important, not only because of the level of scholarship in it, but also because Italy has been a peculiarly overlooked area of research in English-speaking historiography. Our guests tonight are Professor Vassori from the University of Padua. He is professor in international relations at Padova. He is many things. I'm going to say only a few of those. He is a member of the Senate, of the Academic Senate of that ancient seat of learning. He is the chair, the chairman of the Liaison Committee of Historians of Contemporary Europe, a member of the Committee for the Classification of Documents in the Italian Foreign Ministry. His research spans nearly one and a half centuries, if not two, in chronological interest. His themes of research are diplomatic history, the Cold War, Western Europe, the history of Italy, even the history of Greece. He has written seminal works on the Second World War, the First World War, numerous articles that has been translated from Italian, English, French, and German. His two most recent publications are, I'll give you the English translation, The Radiant May, How Italy Entered the War. That is the war with capital W, so it is the First World War, which was published in 2015. And his most recent publications is the volume we are discussing tonight, which was published by Palgrave a few months ago in late 2017. Dr. Benedetto Zaccaria is based at the University, the European University Institute in Florence. He specializes in the history of the Cold War, European integration. His particular focus is the Mediterranean and the Balkan regions. He is the author of many articles, and his two most recent publications are the books, the EC's Yugoslav Policy in the Cold War, 1968 to 1980, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2016, and obviously he's the co-editor of the current volume. Once Professor Vassori and Dr. Zaccaria introduced the book, then our panelists will comment on it. The first panelist is Dr. Irini Karamuzi, a senior lecturer in history at the University of Sheffield, director of the Network for Cold War Cultures, a fellow of LSEADS in Oxford. She is a historian of the Cold War, European integration, the Balkans, and Greece. Her monograph, Greece, the EC and the Cold War, 1974 to 1979, the second enlargement, was published by Palgrave in 2014, and her co-edited volume on the Balkans and the Cold War was published by the same publisher in 2017. Professor Piers Ludlow is Professor of International History at the LSE. He is also the Deputy Head of the Department of International History. Until recently, he was the head of the Cold War Studies program at LSEADS. His main research interests lie in the history of European integration, the Cold War, and transatlantic relations. His latest publications include the co-edited volume, The European Commission, 1973-1986, History, Memories of an Institution, the monograph, Roy Jenkins and European Commission Presidency, The European Commission Presidency, 1976-1980. The subtitle was At the Heart of Europe. If I were to publish it today, I would have a few question marks. that book was published again by Palgrave in April 2016. Professor Zuburg will be our last but not least commentator. He is professor in international history at the International History Department of the LSE. His expertise lies in the Cold War, the Soviet Union, Stalinism, and Russian intellectual history in the 20th century. I've known him since 1995. His most recent books, I'm not going to tell you how long I've known the others because it's even more disappointing. His most recent books are The Idea of Russia, the Life and Work of Dmitry Likhachev, it was published in 2017. However, no introduction to Professor Zuburg's work would be adequate without a mention to his book, A Failed Empire, the Soviet Union in the Cold War from Stalin to Gorbachev, which was published in 2007. I do not wish to take any more time. Let us focus on this significant publication. Antonio, please. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organizer of this meeting, of this initiative. Effi Pedaglio, whom I know since some time, you know. a few years. For organizing this initiative and this presentation of the volume which myself and Dr. Zaccaria, we edited just a few months ago in this very nice series of which Effie and John Young are the two editors. And of course, I would like also to thank my colleagues, the three commentators, and Piers, Irini, and Vlad, and person whom I know fairly well and with whom I had the opportunity to work on different occasions and in different research projects and initiatives. And of course also the audience, because it seems that there was something wrong in the in the volume, because the subtitle see the underrated delight, so it's not true, you know. It seems that it's well rated, you know. For, I didn't think, you know, that so many people may be interested in Italy's foreign policy during the Cold War. So I was wrong, and I am pleased that to be wrong. Well, just a few remarks about this volume. Well, I mean, although I just said that I was wrong, if you give a look, you know, to the historiography, especially the historiography on the Cold War in English, I would say that on Italy there is not too much, you know, with a few exceptions, I mean. Italy seemed to be interested in the context of the Cold War as far as the, I would say, the late 1940s, especially the beginnings of the Cold War, I mean, 1945, 1948, and so Italy's involvement in the Cold War period, and we have a few interesting research and some interesting book by English-speaking scholars. I remember perhaps the first one, the important volume by Jimmy Miller, you know, about the United States and Italy, the politics and diplomacy of stabilization. And very recently, the work more or less on the same period occurs by Katie Mistry, who is a lecturer at the University of East Anglia, and of course I am not forgetting, you know, the volume by Effie on Britain, Italy, and the Cold War. So there was something about that. And of course there was also something about the 1970s, but especially, well, on a very definite issue, which was the question of, well, Eurocommunist and the communist, the Italian Communist Party in the 1970s, and why the Italian Communist Party was unable in the 1970s to come to power and to become part of an Italian government. You know. But with these two exceptions, I would say that there is not so much. I would say almost nothing about the 1960s, for example, nothing about the 1950s and so on. And what really strikes me is that there is not too much about the 1980s, you know, which was a period in which, on the contrary, Italy tried to play some leading role in international relation, especially during the period of the Craxi government, you know, and also the Spadolini government. What about the Italian historiography? Well, in this case, I would say that especially during the last 10, 15 years, there was, on the contrary, a growing interest in the bull period of the so-called First Republic, you know, which means from 1945, 1946, till the end of the so-called, I go on calling it the so-called First Republic, because if you have no real change in the Constitution, in my opinion, we are still, to a certain extent, in the First Republic, although, you know, if you give a look to the Italian press, it seems that they are also the second. It's over, and we are more or less in the Third Republic. I wasn't able to understand that, you know, but, you know, in the Italian press they say that we are in the Third Republic, which, in my opinion, is a bit bizarre, but anyway. The Italian historians, you know, during the last 10, 15 years, I think after the clean ends, you know, the so-called Tangentopoli period, they began to think how to explain how everything happened, you know, why, you know, there was the end of a political system after the end of the Cold War, and they thought that it was possible to explain this big change in the Italian history, also on the basis of a reassessment of the wool experience of the Italian Republic between the 1940s and the early 1990s, not only taking into consideration only the domestic aspects, you know, but also the close connection between what in Italy we call the nesso nazionale internazionale, which means more or less the close link between domestic aspects and international aspects, you know. Because this is just an example, you know. If we think about the Cold War period, I would say that for in Italy, the Cold War was not only a question of foreign policy, but it was a question of domestic policy. And the two aspects, I mean, domestic policy and foreign policy, they were closely connected, closely linked. So you can understand the Italian recent history, not only if you think about what happened, you know, in the internal dimension, but also if you take into consideration the fact that Italy was a sort of border of the Cold War, and that for the Italian public, Cold War was something which must be taken into consideration every day, you know, because if you voted for the Communist Party, for example, or if you take into consideration, you know, the political election, any political election was not only a question of domestic policy, but it was a question of foreign policy too, you know. And that's just an example. On the other end, another question was the fact that Italy and the Italian political leadership, I mean, political decision makers, diplomats, and so on, from the I would say from the 1940s onwards, you know, from the end of the Second World War till the end of the political party system, they had just one important goal. And this important goal was to recover for Italy at least the role of a middle rank power, no longer a great power, luckily, you know, after the experience of the fascist period and the Second World War, but at least of a middle rank power, which could exert some influence, at least in the two traditional areas of Italy's foreign policy, one, Europe, the second, the Mediterranean, but a large Mediterranean, which are, to a certain extent, also some areas of the Middle East and some areas of the African continent. There was a real effort in order, you know, to impose or to promote Italy's international role. And so I think there is this was the sort of gap between Onanda and the new interpretation which Italian historians are going to give about Italy's international role, and on the other, the fact that usually international historiography appear to forget this aspect of Italy's history, at least of the history of the Italian Republic. I don't want to waste much time, and I would say anyway that the volume, which was the outcome of a national research project, I think that the main goal, the main attempt, you know, by this research project was to try to examine Italy's position in the period of the Cold War, not only through the viewpoint of a traditional diplomatic historian, you know, and there were new approaches, you know, to the history of international relations, and in this volume, you'll find these new approaches. For example, the role of the political parties of the movements in shaping Italy's attitude in the Cold War period, or, for example, the question of scientific and technological cooperation, which was important. You know, it's Italy's attitude, and just a further example, appeared to be a bit contradictory. I remember the question of the Eureka project, which was launched by Mitterrand in the mid 1980s. Italy was pro-European in words. And then Eureka was not important for the Italian decision makers. And the Italian decision makers in this area prefer to maintain a close form of scientific and technological cooperation with the United States. You know, it was a tradition, you know. So it's a very interesting aspect. Or another approach is the one about cultural, you know, historical approach, and the question, for example, of the attitude towards the environment and so on. And last but not least, I would say, as I am a diplomatic historian, also there is some diplomatic history in in the volume too. And so the volume is the attempt to show the different approaches which the most recent Italian historiography try to have as far as Italy's international role is concerned. I don't want to go into detail of the different essays which you can find in the volume. I hope there will be some questions, some discussion as a result of the attitude and comments by our colleagues, and I will stop here, and I thank you again for this opportunity, which in my opinion is important, not for myself, but I would say for the generation of Italian international historia, which is not a, you know, only my generation, but, you know, of somebody younger, you know, definitely younger than me, you know, and so thank you very much again, and I hope that there will be a good discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Effie. So I won't add too much to what Professor Vassoli has already said. Just thank you also on my behalf to Effie, to the commentators, and to the public. Just three quick points. The first on the sources we use for this volume. As you know, everybody who is doing research on Italian history has to face one big challenge, namely sources, diplomatic sources for the 60s and 70s, not to speak for the 80s, are not available at in the Foreign Ministry archives. So people focusing on Italian foreign policy are almost obliged to carry out multi-archival research and focus on alternative archives very often. And in this volume, I think one can find many of these alternative archives. We have archives of the Bank of Italy, for example, are included as far as economic questions are concerned. Archives of political parties, which are crucial in many regards. And also archives of international organizations dealing with Italy. One example is the archives of the European Space Agency, which was used by David Burigana for his chapter on technological cooperation. And so I think that also from this viewpoint of archival sources, this volume might be of some interest. Another point on an aspect which I found somehow interesting when I was editing the volume, that is the continuity which was already highlighted by Professor Vassoli. Namely, we are used to consider Italy as a highly unstable country, a country when many governments come, pass, fall, rise. And I think that also specialists in Italian foreign policy could have somehow some difficulty, for example, to remember who was foreign minister in 1975, who was prime minister at that time. But actually, you find that there was continuity in the people who were leading the foreign policy of the country, regardless to what was their position. They may be prime ministers, minister of foreign affairs, or just members of the party, but they were leading the country, and this is reflected, of course, in the continuity of the foreign policy of the country, which was highlighted by Professor Vassoli. So a continuity which can be easily detected in the Atlantic choice of the country, on some regional interest in the Mediterranean region, above all, but also in the Balkans. There is some reference in Antonio Vassoli's chapter on the Italians' attempt to keep the unity of Yugoslavia when the country was falling apart in the early 1990s. And of course, one fil rouge which crosses all chapters, almost all chapters, is the European choice, which is almost present. And I hope, and this is my last point, that this volume might be interesting not only for those focusing on Italian foreign policy or Italian affairs, but also for those focusing on other aspects, because one of the points which we emphasized is that Italy was important because it lay on the fault line between the East-West divide, but also in the North-South divide. And so this is a good observation point, I think, for historians in general. That's all. Thank you.
Dr. Caramusi.
Thank you so much, and Effie for organizing everything, and LSE Ideas. I did read the book. The great opportunity with being a discussant that you are forced to read the book, which is a rarity when you're having all that work overall. But I have to say, it's really an exquisite book, and it's a great addition. And it's not just about modern Italy; it is about international history of the 20th century, really. And what I was really kind of surprised, and I won't talk a lot because there are two other commentators after me, but what really surprised me is that there are kind of like three or four themes that run through all of the chapters, and that seems to be quite the success of such an edited volume. So one of the things that I really kind of enjoyed as a Cold War historian, at least, is that you engage with what Federico Romero has called that we shouldn't be addressing Cold War history in a singular manner because that's impossible, so we should be talking about Cold War histories in plural. And what he was kind of trying to explore is that we have kind of this local vernaculars. Cold War means different things to different countries, to different people, political parties. So I think what you've tried to do is give the Italian version by not excluding it from the international developments. So I think there is an Italian Cold War element into the volume, and I think it has to do with the fact that Silvio Pons states, I think, so well in his chapter where he says, Cold War is a problem and a solution for Italy. And he claims it, and he says that phrase, which I think is quite interesting, and I think it relates to other countries that are enduring the Cold War at the time, is that it's a solution because what does the Cold War does, that kind of the lack of flexibility, is that it keeps the system in place. A system that if you release it, if there is not this external constraint, as we call it in Italian literature, and you can say the same about the Greek literature as well, is that if you release it, then all of the divisions come to the surface. So I think what Antonio asked in the beginning, why did the political system of Italy implode the minute that the Cold War ended? Like what was happening in other countries of Eastern Europe? So I think it's a very pivotal question. Was it related to the Cold War? Did the Cold War froze into place this political system, this lack of national unity to the detriment of the Cold War? But also, it was a solution in many ways, and you saw that in the development chapters on economic aid. This was a modernization project. Italy was part of all this kind of Cold War brainchild, so it benefited. But it seems to be an internal struggle in the country of how are you going to benefit, you know, from the Cold War imperatives, but also how are you going to restrain that influence that is coming either from the United States or from European partners. And I think Italy throughout its history has been struggling with that element. Which leads me to my second point, this theory of dependence. I think what is interesting about Italy, no matter how much it's trying to get away from its southern European partners, is that it shares this kind of southern European syndrome. And what do I mean by that? That ultimately Italy is able to get a seat at the table, either at G6, G7, European Economic Community, NATO, because what Italy claims, it's its fragility. That is the selling point. The selling point is not we're important, we have to be there. We were too big to fail, in a way. So it's interesting that pertains and percolates in the history of Italy and in other countries of Southern Europe. And Italy, of course, detests that. It looks at the North. It doesn't look at Southern European partners. But it's interesting that throughout its narrative and its rhetoric and how the country built the alliance, that volume does an excellent job in really showcasing that sense of dependence and how it, in a way, follows the political parties. and also influences the political culture. I think this is where, Lomellini and Benedetto's chapter is so interesting, because they talk about how this, you know, if you've been projecting your country as weak, as needing that kind of external help, therefore the people buy into it. And the moment that threat, let's say, disappears, what do you do with it? And I think, you know, it carries from the top to the bottom. And I think this book is the first attempt to look at the bottom as well, how this kind of theories and narratives that political parties and elites are advancing, how much do they actually translate within the public, which you see now in Italy. And I think what is interesting about Italy, and that's the, kind of the third theme, is that there are two constant, in a way, two concentric circles. And one is Atlanticism, and the other one is European integration. And it's interesting because Europe, in the period that the book is covering, is not contested. This is actually one arena which seems that the political parties, even PCI, the Communist Party, after, you know, Eurocommunism is launched, seem to be embracing the European option, where Atlanticism is much more contested. So that's a different story from what we have now. So it's very, very interesting how Europe, I mean, one of the things I was wondering, how Europe, you know, turned from being a unifying element to being such a divisive element that we see now. But I think what is interesting about Atlanticism, at least, when you see that, you can understand a little bit of how, you know, political parties and people were discussing this, you know, what vision of the United States was fitting the Italian political climate, but also that there was, you know, they were kind of, it's interesting that Italians could understand that they could diversify between, you know, the American government policy making, but also what they call the Latra America, which is, you know, the demonstrations, the non-governmental, other kind of interest groups that were kind of involved within the Italian case study. And the last point in this kind of like really interesting idea is that what I see in all these chapters when they look at technology or economic development, there seems to be a struggle between national solidarity, as you call it in many chapters, and I'm kind of wondering if you were giving a definition of that, because if as a Greek I was talking about national solidarity, I would have to really explain myself, what do I mean by that? There are ethical and, you know, political repercussions. But there seems to be a distinction between a struggle, that's a better word, between national solidarity and what they call, you know, external constraint and international responsibilities. And it seems to be a perennial question. Why has not Italy been able to reconcile? Why this seems to be contradictory? Why can you not have international commitments to the benefit of national solidarity, if that makes sense? But it's a wonderful work, and it's great congratulations to the two editors, because really it's a solid, coherent piece of work. Thank you.
Professor Ladler. Thank you very much. Okay, well, first of all, many thanks to the organisers for inviting me. So I'm part of the home team, but it's still always a pleasure to have an opportunity to speak, and particularly to speak about what, as all of the contributors so far have emphasised, is both a very important volume and a very good volume. I want to do two things, or at least structure my brief remarks around two themes. The first, I think, is the subject of the volume, and the second are the authors or the contributors to the volume, because I think both need to be, in a sense, underlined in order to appreciate the importance of this book. The first, and in a sense this is picking up where Antonio and others left off, is on the importance of Italy as a subject. It is a very neglected field. It is, if I can use a sort of photographic metaphor, it's in all of the group photos, it's in all of the pictures, but it's always at the edge or slightly out of focus. The camera seems to be pointing elsewhere. It's present, but it's not really what the party seems to be about. And therefore it's very useful and very important to have a volume which in a sense faces squarely onto Italy as a key player in its own right, rather than as a sort of adjunct or as the sort of semi-forgotten country. I also think it's very important to have a volume that traces carefully Italy's transition in the course of the Cold War period from the sort of object of diplomacy to a subject in its own right. Now, of course, Italy is not the only country in Europe to make that transition. And one of Italy's problems, in a sense, is that it has tended always to be overshadowed by the other country that makes that transition, namely the Federal Republic of Germany. It, too, goes from being object to subject. But although there are deficiencies in the literature that we have on Germany, that is vastly bigger than the literature we have on it than Italy. So it's very useful, again, to have something that addresses the balance. I also want to emphasize how important the Italians become as an actor on the international stage during the Cold War period. The Italians did not tend to act by themselves in a sort of attention-grabbing fashion, but precisely because they became very good multilateral players, underrated multilateral players, I think they matter considerably in the international system. In my own field, which is particularly focused on the European Community during this period, European Union as it subsequently, of course, became, the Italians are extremely influential actors. They don't grab the headlines. The focus overwhelmingly of journalists and of commentators and of others as they try and seek to explain decision-making at a European level is to look at Paris, to look at Bonn, perhaps sometimes to look at London. Very seldom do they look at Rome itself. And yet, actually, at a whole series of moments, whether it be the original formation of the European Community in the 1950s, its development during the 1960s, its further development during the 70s and 80s, the Italians actually play a really important role which does tend to be neglected and which, amongst other things, this volume helps tease out. But it's not just within a community context. It's also within a NATO context. It's also in a transatlantic context. I've done quite a bit of work reading the American presidential archives on transatlantic relations during the Cold War period for a volume which eventually I will get round to writing on the transatlantic dynamics during the Cold War period. And again, it's interesting that Italy is there partly as an subject, partly as an object, partly as a subject. It's a matter of concern, it's a matter of discussion, but it is also quite an important actor. And the Italians became very adept at playing various American governments and various American presidents and sort of punching above their weight, as the British like to claim, in an interesting way. Sort of, I'm always struck, or rather annoyed, by the way in which the rhetoric of the special relationship in this country tends to sort of focus on its exclusivity. What actually strikes me about the Cold War period is that we have a sort of multiplicity of special relationships, and the Italian-American one is one amongst many. It has its problems, it has its weaknesses, and both parties are pretty rude about the other behind their backs, but that's the nature of relationships. I will say no more. But it does strike me that that is often neglected by international historians. And I think one of the other strengths of this volume is that it captures the way in which Italy also sought to become a player in North-South relations in a way which is often overlooked. That's something that, again, tends to be looked at by international historians through the lens of one of the traditional bigger powers, and therefore the Italian role is not seen, not noticed, not discussed. And this volume redresses that and goes and sort of rescues that role in an important way. But let me jump to my second theme, which is the cast list of contributors rather than the cast list of sort of foreign policy actors. Because I think here, too, the volume makes a very, very important, does a very important service. Now, I was lucky enough to be brought up partly in Italy, and so I do actually speak Italian and read Italian. And so I look at this volume and see, in a sense, a collection of international historians writing that I know, who I respect, whose ideas I have long enjoyed discussing and talking to, but whose ideas and whose views have, in a sense, been far too restricted in terms of their international circulation. There has long been an extremely lively international historical discussion going on in Italy in Italian.
But although some members of the Italian international history community have published quite a lot in English and have got international reputations, rather a lot of people have not. And that is frustrating. And again, one of the great merits of this volume is it takes this genuinely really good group of international scholars and puts them in a position where their work is accessible to an English-speaking audience and to those who don't read Italian and don't go to those conferences. And I think this is particularly important to touch upon a point that Benedetta raised earlier, because of their archival sources. So Irene was talking about the Cold War as both Italy's problem and Italy's solution. In some ways, the Italian archival system is both Italy's problem and Italy's solution. Because the archival, the obvious archives of the foreign ministry, etc., the sort of the archives that one would normally go to as a historian, have not been accessible. A lot of these Italian historians, represented in this volume and others besides, have had to be really imaginative, really creative, in finding other sources. They've had to, as Benedetta said, go to the parties, go to individual archives, go to some of the sort of institutions that might otherwise have been on the margins. They've also had to go international. It's extraordinary how often when one goes to the National Archives or whatever, or the French archives, one encounters Italian scholars who are in those archives, partly writing the history of their own country from those perspectives. Now, that's not necessarily ideal, but it does actually force a sort of degree of internationalism that, for instance, we Brits tend to not adopt, partly because we're not very good at foreign languages, but partly also because we're lucky, in a sense, enough to have a very good archive on our doorstep. And for many PhD students, for many British scholars, they never go any further than Kew. That's the end of the line. That's all that they need, and they can just feed off these archives. Whereas, in a sense, because the Italian system has not had that one-stop shop, Italian historians have had to be that much more imaginative in what they do. And I think it's fantastic that we've now got a volume that projects these people, these ideas, but also these methodologies onto the international stage and makes them that much more accessible to a wider public. So I urge you to look at the volume, to read it, and to take it very seriously as a lesson, not just about what you should study as an international historian, but also how you should study and how you should use archives. Thank you.
All right, being the last, because of the curse of the alphabet, I have to be really imaginative. I would start with a note of Piers, who made such an impassionate plea for the restrictions on the British archives so that we can boost our scholarship here. What can I say? I always drink to the openness of archives. That's my kind of international toast. With this volume, I say, you know, to say that Italy punched above its weight is not to say that the group of authors of this volume punched above its weight. We're not surprised by the high quality of this volume, because Italy, as we all know, is the country of immense cultural heritage and immense political experience. It's the country of Machiavelli, among all other people. So what is, however, for me, important in this volume, it's the level of self-criticism, not personal here in this case, but openness to criticism about what happened and is happening to the country since the 70s and until now. And that is the level of self-criticism, openness and candidness that, you know, is not always replicated in the books about other countries. I wish we had a series of books like that, accessible, small size, relatively small size in English, on all members of the European Union. And we cannot. And it's kind of a worrying thought that we cannot produce probably such a book, I'm sorry, on Greece maybe, and maybe on some other countries. I shouldn't continue, really. But we have it on Italy, and we're lucky to have it. What this book kind of made me think about as one of the first readers is, above all, it is a surprising story that with all international implications, with the Cold War and all those, you know, factors of importance that Italians kind of with their usual eloquence and elegance call vincolo esterno. It's so beautiful. It's not so beautiful in practice, but it's very beautiful to pronounce. With all this, power starts at home. And the role that country can play, punching above or below its weight, starts with a domestic consensus. And this is the story how this consensus begins to unravel. From the period of the 70s during the detente up to the early 90s when some authors of the volume use such words as collapse, irretrievable, irrefutable, catastrophe, tragedy, and these words that you normally don't hear from historians of so-called Western Europe. You hear these words about Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union. So what do we have here? We definitely have a story of relative success of Italy in the first 25 years after the fall of fascism, with crisis, but then those crises and the favorite motto of the LSE were turned into opportunities. There were solutions found and used. And then the time came when those challenges and dangers stopped providing solutions. The 70s was still the time of major challenge, but the 70s also kind of allowed Italy to muddle through due to couple of factors I will dwell upon a little bit later. So what is this story? From success to failure. Rise and fall, but not of a great power. Rise and fall, well, we don't apply the rise and fall to subalterns, but Italy is somewhere in between, subalterns and great powers. Mid-tier, second tier. So what happened? If we look at this story, we find in the book that there was not only one vincolo esterno. There are three. And I would compare it to an elegant Italian 1960s style chair that has three legs. And actually, I had such a chair when I grew up in Moscow. We all looked up to Italy for elegance. So actually, you can sit on such a chair because it's stable. You have three legs. So leg number one was, of course, the United States. Of course. And we actually find from the book that there were crises, the Vietnam War, you know, the end of the Golden Standard. But at every point, with remarkable agility, Italians themselves repaired this leg by inventing the Second America. And this continues to today, practically, to Donald Trump, because Obama was, of course, another America. Of course, after such a calamity of George Bush, you know, Jr., and so on and so forth, another America came to power. But now, you know, I'm afraid this leg is off, knocked off. The second leg, of course, is communism and the Soviet Union. There's a quotation in the book, I forgot in which chapter, that Henry Kissinger explodes by saying, it doesn't matter for me if PC, Communist Party of Italy, is dependent on the Soviet Union or not. It's all the same. PC can destroy NATO. He was slightly coquettish because everybody knew that the Soviet Union did stand behind PC and continued to find Communist Party of Italy, even when there were all these ideological, you know, divergences about détente and, you know, Eurocommunism and so on and so forth. But then, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed. And look what happened to PC immediately. So that leg that allowed for domestic consensus in various ways, and it was a factor of stabilization. Silvio Pons mentions in the volume, by the way, that was one of three major factors for Italian stability. This leg was knocked off by the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. So, leg number three, Europe. And you know, with this, we re-enter the world, and the book does it very, very well, the world of domestic Italian consensus, and why at some point Italy, its elites above all, of course, its elites, but with some consent, with some democratic consent, decided to plunge ahead and go forward with the Euro project. Because by that time, domestic resources of balancing payment, balancing sharing of profits between labor and das Kapital in Italy came to an end. Were exhausted by previous compromises, solutions, and so on. So it was the last solution, as the volume tells us, the last solution to externalize the challenges, to make Italian workers, to put it bluntly, look not towards their government, but towards Brussels as the source from where all the policy come. And look what happened during the last few years. This exteriorization from a positive factor became a negative factor, quite clearly. So we have, indeed, in the country that has never had a dearth of political talents, from Machiavelli to Camillo Cavour and so on and so forth, Andreotti is on the cover, right? Of course. Now we have the situation when all three legs that kept Italy intact are off, and there's a dearth of political personalities that can be inventive and imaginative enough to manage on their own. It's really a tragedy. But thank you for your honest story.
Thank you very much to the introducers and commentators. And now I would like to open it to questions. Yes.
Hello. Hi, so obviously today is a very important day in Italy because it's 40 years from two tragic assassinations, one of the statesmen, Aldo Moro, and of the anti-mafia activist, Pepe Impastato in Sicily. So I guess it's worth the question whether those two major themes of Italy, so the war against the mafia and in the 70s opposing extremisms and terrorism, had what links they had with the Cold War. So maybe one is more obvious with the same ideological family that inspired the Red Brigades, or maybe some less obvious links also with the mafia in those years, whether such a frozen system allowed maybe some certain phenomena to be to grow more easily.
Well, first of all, I would like to thank everybody for, especially the commentators, for the many suggestions and the many useful remarks also for future research, I would say. Thank you very much indeed. As far as your question, well, I mean, obviously there are different interpretations. Well, of course, I will say, at first I will deal with the question of the terrorism in the 1970s, you know, and then about the mafia. What's the question of the 19, of the terrorism? You know, there have been several interpretations about, you know, possible connection and possible international links, so especially of the Red Brigades, you know, with foreign powers and so on, you know. Personally, I do think that there were no such close links, you know. The Red Brigades were just a domestic phenomenon. And obviously, the question is more, which was the impact of the Italian situation on the interpretation, the perception, you know, other actors had of Italy in the 1970s. So was Italy so weak? Was Italy on the eve of collapse and so on? Think about I think somebody quoted, you know, or I quote some in another volume, the famous cover page of the, I forgot now the name of the well-known German magazine, you know. It's called, and it was, you know, the spaghetti in salsa chilena, you know, spaghetti in Chilean sauce, you know. And the cover was, you know, a dish of spaghetti with a gun, you know, on the dish of spaghetti, you know. I would say that I dislike very much, you know, this sort of cover, you know. And but you think there was the impact, I mean, the perception, you know, several European, and not only European milieu, had of Italy in the 1970s. So a country which was more or less abandoning, you know, the European continent and becoming a sort of Latin American country, you know. So the idea, well, there may be a coup d'etat or maybe, you know, a sort of left revolution, perhaps on the model of what happened in Portugal in 1974. Of course, the Italian situation was completely different, you know, and was a completely different question. And I think, anyway, that the impact of what happened in Italy in the domestic situation was important in shaping sometimes the attitude of Western political leaders. You know, the idea: okay, Italy is a problem. You know, Italy is must become an object of foreign policy. In the 1970s, Italy was an object rather than a subject of foreign policy. Although, you know, the Italian politicians, they try to avoid the sort of difficult situation. Obviously, also do a distinction between different periods. For example, in my opinion, there was a real fear of what may happen in Italy, which meant the Communist Party coming to power, 1975-1976. You know. And what happened, it's of much interest, because it was not mainly the United States which tried, you know, to intervene in the Italian internal situation, because in the 1975-1976 it was the Ford administration, which was very weak, but it was the European partners, you know, and especially, you know, West Germany under a social democrat chancellor and France under Giscard d'Estaing. Well, the Brits were more cautious, you know, I would say, you know, but it was there, you know, the famous Puerto Rico summit, you know, the second G7, you know, and on this occasion, nothing, you know, there was no need of covert operation, you know, old style, you know. It was just a way to say, well, you need a strong financial support of why the International Monetary Fund. Well, in this case, the Italian communists had not to be member of the government. And the Italian solution was the Italian solution, you know, the Andreotti government, you know. So the communists were not there. They did not vote in favor of the government, but they abstained, which was more or less a sort of support of the government, you know. So I think there was the Italian way. In 1978, I think it was different. There was less fear, you know, in the international in the national system, and the more case, after a few months, if you give a look, you know, to the analysis, you know, the Western powers, usually was, okay, there is a reaction on the part of the Italian, not of the Italian political parties, on the Italian public opinion, you know, and there is no support of the Red Brigade, you know. The thousands of Italians in the street, you know, against the terrorism, so it's evidence that there is a reaction. So things are going to change. Well, as far as the mafia is concerned, I mean, in this case, I saw mafia as an Italian internal domestic problem. Once again, obviously, with a strong impact on the perception and the attitude of international milieu. In this case, I would say that more the mafia, I think the impact of mafia in international milieu was stronger in the early 1990s, the Falcone and Borsellino. That was more important. In the 1970s, as far as the international public opinion was, the way of kidnapping, you know, that was regarded as more dangerous, and the evidence of weakness of the Italian state system, more than political system.
Thank you. More questions?
I would like to join the question before about Aldo Moro. This state man was killed 40 years ago because he was the political person who was trying from member of the Democrazia Cristiana, Christian Democratic Party in Italy, that was going to have a project of sharing a government with the Communist Party. And this... this political person was kidnapped and eventually killed by the Red Brigades. And there are still some debates in Italy that the Italian government at that time, Andreotti, Craxi, they didn't negotiate with the Red Brigades, and they essentially let this person be killed by the Red Brigades. So my question is, what would have happen if the project of having a shared government between the Communist Party or somehow and the Democrazia Cristiana, the Christian Democratic Party, how this would have impacted the Italian politics and, of course, the Cold War? I understand today probably that this was a problem for the U.S., of course, but as you mentioned before, it was probably a big problem for Europe as well, because it would have been for Europe, one of the main founders of the European Union, to have a strong Communist Party, the government. So this is my question, just to link the point of the gentleman. What if, and was that a benefit at the end of the day, sorry to say that this person and his project to open to the Communist Party was aborted, even by being killed for, the interest of the U.S., of course, and the European Union, and the status quo, keeping the stability of keeping the Communist Party out of the government in Italy until after the Cold War was ended.
Of course, we are here in the domain of counterfactual history, and it's quite difficult to give an answer to this question, because all different hypotheses about the kidnapping and then murdering of Aldo Moro are still not the subject of actual historical analysis, because possible connections with foreign powers, foreign influence, is still the domain of journalistic investigation for the time being. At least, we carried out a research project on the possible international connections and influences on Italian terrorism in the 70s, and with the investigation in American archives, British archives, French archives, and also archives from several Eastern European countries. And the result was that actually there was no real role intervention in that moment in time, in 78. And so there is no evidence that there was this external influence that you were mentioning.
Was a benefit for the US, for the status quo, and for Europe. So, what if things were gone in a different way, or would have been the impact on the Cold War and on the Italian?
I think it's very difficult to say. What I may say, anyway, is that I have some doubts that, and it's also one of the, I would say, most recent interpretation about Aldo Moro policy. I have some doubts that Moro's intention was to share the power with the communists. Moro's intention was to delay and not do it, you know, to delay and with the idea we'll see in the future, you know. And the question was that Aldo Moro was very pessimist about its own his own political party, you know. He was pessimistic about the Christian democracy, but I think he was trying to gain time. And so we can discuss with the communists, we can have some relations with them, but not being a part of a government. You know, I think that Moro was not convinced that the communists would, that he would the right choice to have the communists in the party. Think a bit about what I said before, you know, the Andreotti solution, you know. The communists could support us, but they are not member of the government. And also after 1978, where there was this whole solidarity government, you know, and the Communist Party voted in favor of this government, but there was no communist minister and no member of the Communist Party was member of this government. As far as the question of the United States attitude towards war kidnapping, I really don't know. We would say that there was this research project and we had no evidence at all, you know. Obviously, we may say that you said Craxi and Andreotti, their position were very different, you know. Craxi was in favor of a negotiation with the Red Brigades, you know. And while on the contrary, well, Andreotti tried not to have a so definite position. I mean, he left to Cossiga, you know, the role of saying, okay, no to any negotiation and so on. Personally, I must tell you what I think as a citizen, more as an historian, and I think that it was a sort of, or at least what I thought at that time, personally, not as an historian, you know, there was no other option, you know. Of course, I regret it, you know, as a person, as a citizen, I regretted that Moro was killed. But there was no other option, and not for international problems, but for internal question, you know, because the Italian states had to show that it existed, you know. And the only way to show, in my opinion, you know, I may be wrong, but at that time, that was my opinion. Of course, I regret, of course, I think I was very unhappy of what happened, but the only way was to say, okay, there is no negotiation with the Red Brigades. And we must not forget, there was the turning point. At that time, somebody thought this is a victory of the Red Brigades. It was the failure. And it was the first real failure, you know, of the defeat of the Red Brigades. And what happened later on, I think it was evidence of that, you know, because there was a change in the attitude of the public opinion, you know. Till 1978, it was not true that the Red Brigade, they were isolated and just a few thousand. No. There was a gray zone of hundreds of thousands of Italians who said, well, why not? Okay, I don't like, but, you know, I can understand their position. After the killing, the murder of Aldo Moro, I think the attitude of most Italians changed. We cannot go on with that, you know. The Red Brigades are something wrong, and we have to defeat them. So there was a change. Of course, I can say, okay, I regret that Aldo Moro was killed, obviously. But he was not killed by the Italian states. He was killed by the Red Brigades. That we must remember that. But it's a personal opinion as a citizen. As an historian, it's a different matter.
Just very quickly on the counterfactual, I think actually the degree of anxiety which Antonio has already spoken about, that was caused by the prospect of communist membership in the Italian government, actually says a lot about outside attitudes towards Italy and a degree of paranoia more than the intrinsic problem. It's worth remembering that 3 years later, the Mitterrand government had communist ministers, and yet there was barely a flicker of concern elsewhere. And so I think it is connected with this idea that some of Italy's partners have tended to have a kind of somewhat paranoid view about Italian stability, which in many ways was unjustified, but which explains the extremism of the concerns that Antonio was talking about earlier.
Thank you for this presentation and, of course, for the book. My question deals with a slightly different aspect, namely European integration. More specifically, I would like to ask whether you think that the type of European integration, and especially European monetary cooperation in the 1970s and 80s, did play a role in undermining Italy's political system. I think an argument can be made about the role that public deficits played in bringing some stability into the post-war system, although, I mean, you don't really want to stretch too much. Do you think that there is any link between the type of monetary cooperation that was pursued after the oil shock and the downfall of the so-called First Republic and the demise of the main political parties? Thanks.
Well, I thank you very much for this question, because that's a topic on which I worked much, you know, in the past. I will not think, that it was the 1970s or the 1980s, you know, which caused, which was among the reason of the collapse, which happened later on, you know. Also because we must not forget that, Italy, for example, tried to be involved in the first attempt of monetary union, which was the snake, you know. And, you know, it lasted a few months and then it came out, you know. And then the decision in 1978, 1979, to take part to the European monetary system, that was a real turning point, you know, because we must not forget that it was the first reason on which there was a break in the solidarity government, you know. For Andreotti, it was a difficult choice, because he knew fairly well that his government is going to lose the support of the Communist Party, because it's a bit bizarre, because the Communist Party was in favor of Europe and so on, and the European integration and Spinelli and so on. And then in 1978, he voted against, you know, Italian participation of the European monetary system. He was not against the European monetary system, but he was against the fact that Italy will become immediately member of the European monetary system, because the idea was that's what the Germans want from Italy, the end of the so-called, competitive devaluations, you know, which was the characters of Italian decision in monetary politics during the 1970s. We have some problems, okay, we devaluated the lira, so there is a boom in export, and that's good. But of course, it was not the idea of the Germans, you know. And we must not forget, it was also a period of high inflation. During the 1980s, there was an increase in the deficit spending, but Italy was able to fight against inflation. You know, in the early 1980s, the inflation was about 22% per year. At the end of the decade, was a 4.5%, you know, something like that. You know, and in this period, I don't think that Europe and the European choices were so important for the majority of the Italians, you know. The Cold War, NATO, the Mediterranean, the Middle East, these were the most important issues, you know. The European community was something a bit far, you know. Somebody in Brussels were dealing with very difficult, complex issues in which, we are not so much involved. In my opinion, the real turning point as far as Europe was the early 1990s, you know. And in particular, the question of not only the European Union and Maastricht, and so not only the famous five parameters and so on, you know, the five criteria, but the decision by Italy to accept the hypothesis of starting with the EMU, the European Monetary Union, you know. And the fact that, in my opinion, only very few in the Italian political elite, in the Italian political class, were able to understand the implication and consequences of that, you know. I working on the Andreotti papers, and it's revealing, you know. For example, the President of the Republic, Cossiga, was one of the few who realized. He wrote a letter to Andreotti, and he said, do you realize what the Maastricht Treaty means for Italian sovereignty in the field of economy and monetary dimension, you know? I think, in my opinion, very few were unable to understand that, you know. So the Maastricht and the end of the Cold War were among the two reasons of the collapse of the First Republic. Obviously, also the corruption and clean hands and so on, you know. But these were the two main questions. Because when there was a collapse of the, I would say, of the confidence in the party system, that's also my interpretation, I may be wrong. In my opinion, some sectors of the Italian elite thought we can, try, if there is no role for the traditional political parties, no problem, the better. We can change. Because the political party, the Italian political party system, are unable to deal with the economic and financial and monetary consequences of the Maastricht Treaty. So it's a way to change. And now we have the opportunity to change, because there is no longer the Cold War. So there is no longer to support the Christian democracy, and so on, and we can find something else, something new. You know, what I say, and what also Vlad stress, Italy is the only Western country which, with the end of the Cold War, saw its political system collapse more like East Central Europe than like Western Europe, you know. It means something, you know. And the connection between domestic question and international aspects, it's important. Without that, you cannot understand what happened in the Italian political system.
I want to add something to what Antonio was saying. I think there is, in contrast to what is happening now, what we know as historians of European integration is that the then European Economic Community did not have so much power to intervene or at least trace the compliance of the member states. I think there is an overestimation of what the European Economic Community at the time was actually ready to do. Member states would conform to reform if they want to be part of the EMS or, you know, afterwards the Single European Act, but there was literally no follow-up in compliance. It took only after the Maastricht Treaty to see the kind of intervention that we see afterwards. I think we do have to bear in mind, which kind of makes me think, because you talk about in the volume and you kind of insinuated now, because it goes back to how much this external constraint of Europe works. Because, you know, it's claimed, and Vlad mentioned it as well, you know, it's always there in Italy. You know, you can use Europe as a, you know, as a scapegoat for reforms that are hard to accept by the public opinion. But how much really was the public opinion interested in European integration in Italy, at least? You know, we talk about permissive consensus in these Cold War years, but I think as historians of European integration, we haven't really kind of, you know, investigated how much the public opinion care about these things. I mean, using Europe as an excuse, was that enough to justify these reforms? Or do we say this now because we know the stark contrast with the dissensus that is, you know, dominating the our European sides and the Italian side? I wonder in Italy, you saw that, you know, that was, it's a good negotiating tool for the elites, but how much was it successful, really, being into that question that was asked now about economic and monetary policy?
I think that became important in the 1990s, in my opinion. Not before. Well, before there was some interest, but not so important, I mean, in the wide, in the wider public opinion, you know. It became important in the 1990s because I think there was also a big change in the, as a consequence of clean hands, you know, and the fall of the political party, of the old political party system, what happened was, on one end, the creation of a new party movement, you know, what you like, which was Forza Italia, I mean, created in a few months by, you know, a businessman, and the only way, well, I don't like the communists, you know, something like that, you know, which had some appeal, you know, in the public opinion. What can be done to counter Forza Italia? What happened was a sort of very bizarre alliance between the former communists, who had always, from since the 1970s, in favor of Europe, you know, the former left wing of the Christian Democrats, and some areas of the lay political party, for example, the Republican, you know. The idea is, what we have in common? Nothing, you know. If we look to the past, there is just one thing which we have in common. We believe in Europe, you know. And the European integration and the idea, we are so strongly in favor of Europe, you know. It's our, you know, the reason why we stay together. And the creation of, it's the idea of the Ulivo and Prodi, you know. The olive tree was the only things which, well, put together, you know, former communists, former Christian Democrats, and former Republican was, what we have in common? The idea that we have confidence in Europe. We are the most pro-European. And they were able to sell Europe to the public opinion. You know, the idea, we must become Europeans. Well, we are Europeans, obviously, you know. But it was the majority of the Italian public opinion, there was a sort of reaction of national pride, you know. We must join the euro because it's a way to show that we are able, you know, to be recognized as Europe. And at the same time, the 1990s, in my opinion, there was usually a positive, you know, image which the European Union was able to project of itself, you know. We are modernity, and we are able to, to reconcile, do things which were, which was impossible to reconcile. The acceptance of globalization, free market, and, you know, and the welfare state. The European Union is able to reconcile both aspects, which means that it works when the economic situation is good, you know. In this case, it's obvious. You can assure everything. And so you can give confidence to Brussels, because Brussels, in 50 years, has assured to Europe, to Western Europe, I mean, economic growth, but at the same time, also, the safeguard of the social state, you know. Think about the law, you know. The four mobilities, it's a neoliberal policy. And the law tried, okay, we can reconcile that with the social dialogue. We put together, you know, and we are able, as Europeans, to work out something which, you know, the Americans are unable to do or somebody else are unable to do. We are able to do. In my opinion, that was the climax of the pro-European attitude of the Italians, you know, and also of the effectiveness by the European Union to sell the European idea. I have, you know, a personal experience, just a personal anecdote, you know, in this period, I set up the first Master in European Studies. I was at the University of Florence. And I experienced the change of the attitude of my best and brightest students, you know. Till the 1990s, what I want to do, you know, in my future. I want to become a member of the Italian diplomacy, you know. That's I want to win the competition for the diplomatic career. Where I want to specialize myself, I want to go to an American university, obviously. I want to go to Berkeley, I want to go to Harvard. After the 1990s was, what I want to become? I want to become an official of the European Union, which is good, in my opinion, you know, obviously, not too bad, especially if you think about the salaries, you know. And the other aspect, where I want to go in order to specialize myself. I want to go to the London School of Economics, you know. Well, also in Paris, you know, also at Sciences Po, you know. But it was a big change, you know. And if you think the change in the students, you think it's a sort of mirror of the change in the attitude of the society, you know, at large. Then things changed a few years ago, but that's another talk.
Are there any more questions?
Really enjoyed the presentation. I don't know hardly anything about Italy's role in the Cold War, and I'm Italian, so. But I was just wondering, in terms of, I look more at US foreign policy, and it does seem that Italy's role is never really kind of looked at. Especially, I was just wondering, in your research, did you cover the Reagan era at all? Because it seems like with Reagan, it's always either the Soviet Union or Latin America, the relationship with Thatcher over the Falklands, and Italy's role just kind of seems to be kind of forgotten, really.
I don't know, what's the... I always wonder, as an Italian... which is the reason, there's a lack of references, and always is, I wrote that, I don't know, perhaps we can come back to cultural studies, and try to understand the psychological attitude of foreign decision makers, and I remember some years ago I spent a lot of time, especially in the past, in the National Archives, and reading hundreds of minutes of Foreign Office officials, dealing with the Italian-British relationship, and I wrote an article in English, I would say, on the attitude of Foreign Office officials towards Italy between 1945 and 1956, and for an Italian it's a bit frustrating, because usually, they say, well, that is, sorry, just bloody Italians, my God. Remarks by Foreign Office officials, the Italians, they are starved beggars, my God, in 1956, oh my God, the Italians, they are doing something in the international system, and of course, it was very easy to say, oh, these silly people, they are unable to understand anything, but it's too easy. I found the explanation of this attitude in a very interesting volume, which was the attitude of the Edwardians and Victorians British travelers to Southern Europe in the late 19th century. And their attitude in the late 19th century was the same of the Foreign Office officials, in the 1950s. So the point is, you have some cultural background, And if your cultural background is based on the fact that, for example, the people of the Grand Tour, especially in Italy, they had two different attitudes, The one was, I love everything of the Italians, Also, the bad habits of the Italians, I like very much, because they are nice people, and they show their sentiments, their feelings, and so on. Well, sometimes they use a knife, or they kill among themselves, but I like it, And because it's so nice, so naive, And think if you look, A Room with a View, you will find that, by Foster. The idea is that, I like. Of course, Harry James had a different attitude towards the Italian. Of course, Harry James was an American, but, the question, if I think about the other part was, the Italian do not deserve their country, because their country is so nice, and so full of history, and the Italians are so corrupt. It's not their fault. It's the fault of the Pope, of the, the fact that they were under foreign rules for a century. But at the end, the problem is there. And, if you grow up, as most Foreign Office officials, but I would say also some politicians, definite school, in some definite colleges, and of course, because your cultural background is this one, you know, and you're thinking that way. And so your psychological attitude and sometimes your interpretation of the events is not so different. You know, I remember which was the nickname, you know, of a poor Count Carandini, you know, which was the first Italian, not ambassador, but diplomatic representative after the end of the Second World War. And poor Count Carandini, he did his job, you know, and he went every day at the Foreign Office and said, well, try to think about Italian plights. And, well, you know, we were enemies, but between 1943 and 1945, we tried to be allied. But of course, the British had a different view. And the poor Count Carandini was called the Weeping Count. Yeah. Because it was every day, it was the Foreign Office said, oh my God, you think about our poor Italians. So I think the Foreign Office officials were really, in my opinion, fed up with poor Count Carandini. Of course, they said, well, it's not too bad. This fellow, you know, is a noble, he's a count, you know. He knows English, you know. But my God, you know, it's so boring. You know?
I am joking a bit, but only to a certain extent.
Before I thank our panel, I would really like to make one comment. I find the idea of the elegance of that Italian chair really nice. However, there is a problem. Italy really needs four legs to balance, and we haven't discussed the fourth leg, and that's the Mediterranean. Yes. But thank you very much, all of you.